Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's always a great day when Patty Nagai stops by in the studio to be with us. And she's with us to talk about, of course, all things gardening and horticulture. But we're going to take a look to begin maybe the show at succession gardening with Patty. She's now the horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Maybe we'll find out what's going on there. She's also a retired horticulture educator with UW Extension and has been with us for a long, long time. We've been doing this together for years and years. What questions do you have about gardening at this time of the year? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Patty Nagai, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me again, Larry. It's always great to be here.
You know, there every day, Jeff Robbins posts the national day. Mm-hmm. So we always have that. And he posted today that today is National Gardening Exercise Day.
I did not realize that, but I will be certain to go home and exercise while I'm gardening.
It's a day to encourage us to maximize our health benefits in the garden.
Well, you know, that's every day for me, honestly. Gardening is so healthful in so many ways. You know, it's therapeutic. It's good for your soul. It's good for your brain. It's good for your muscles. It's good for your flexibility and your strength. There's really nothing bad about gardening. I challenge anyone to tell me anything bad about gardening.
Well, let's see.
Don't mention insects because there are good insects too. He's thinking hard.
I was thinking hard.
See the wheels turning.
I remember the time when I was a kid, I stepped on a nail on my way to the garden.
Yes, I did that. It was kind of like a long tack. I did that too. Yeah, so you know what that tells me?
I wasn't paying attention.
You should have been wearing shoes in the garden, is what it tells me. Because that's the lesson I learned after I stepped on that. Yes, shoes always in the garden. Yes.
Well, since then I was always on the lookout. So that has not happened in a long, long time.
It's important to be aware of your surroundings no matter where you are, for sure.
And I think it's important for folks to know about planting, you know, and timing of planting.
Yes.
A lot of people think, oh, it's too late already to plant.
I hear that every day. It just surprises me so much when people come in and they want to buy, for example, a cucumber plant. And when I tell them it's the perfect time to direct seed in the ground cucumbers, oh, no, I can't do that. It will never work. And I'm like, it's easy. You just, for the same price you're going to pay for a single plant, you could buy an entire packet of seeds and have like 30 plants. It's really interesting that people are so afraid to plant from seed. And the one thing I would like people to understand is that everything you need to know about planting that seed is on the seed packet.
Yeah.
It's right there. It tells you when to plant. It tells you how long it will take for your first harvest. It tells you how deep to plant the seed. Everything is right there on the packet. And so it's not magical, you know, like Jack and the Beanstalk. There's no magic involved. It's just reading. You just need to read the instructions.
Well, and the planting instructions, you know, the seeds, usually you're not planting them very deep.
No, and that, you know, that is one of the problems that people have, is they either plant the seed too deep or too shallow and then something gets it. But the bigger issue for a lot of things like that is that people try to garden too soon. Mm-hmm. You know, in the area of the state where I live, southeast Wisconsin, you know, we had kind of a funky spring.
Yeah.
We had some really warm weather, and then we had some really cold weather. And it turned out that May was like colder than April and March. May was really cold for us. And when you measure the soil temperatures, even in my raised beds, middle of May, my soil was still at 50 degrees, which is too cold for things like cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers and squash. Way too cold. So that that soil temperature is a real key for planting a lot of different types of vegetables.
And I, frankly, if I've got a tomato plant, or plants, I don't put them out until the end of May anyway, mm-hmm. or maybe yeah. even the few days into June.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we do at the greenhouse is we do a lot of container gardening. And when I do classes for container gardening, it's nice with the smaller types of tomatoes that you can put them in a pot, a planter, and take them home. And for the most part, they can stay outside. It's just that nights when we got down to, you know, like 36 degrees, which is too cold for tomatoes, I would tell them, bring the pot inside. But then put it back out during the day because it was getting into the 60s and 70s. So in a container, that soil temperature warms up a lot faster. And, of course, it's mobile, so you can, you know, you can move it into a place that's a little more protected. But when you're planting in the ground, you're exactly right. For even in the southernmost part of the state, our soil temperatures don't get up into the upper 60s and 70s until June.
And don't begin to tell me about peppers. If you put pepper plants in, you'll get these nice plants.
And no fruit.
Yeah. happened to me one year.
Yeah, the same thing can happen with tomatoes planted too early.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I always tell people, you know, you can plant your tomatoes now if you want to, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to plant mine the first week of June. And by the second, third week of June, my tomatoes are going to be bigger than yours. You may have planted yours 2 or 3 weeks before me, but that cold temperature is going to really slow those plants down. So just don't do it.
Barbara in Cross Plains has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. So nice to talk to you about such beautiful subjects. I have, considering how much work I'm doing right now, planting my annuals, watering them, and keeping up with the weeding early, I wonder if I'm maybe making too much work for myself because I want to go out and deadhead the peonies, and I want to cut off the stalks on the ugly irises that are finished. But I notice those plants grow by the wayside beautifully, so am I just making too much work for myself?
You know, deadheading is an interesting subject, you know, cutting off the flower heads from various things. Of course, plants are perfectly fine if you don't do it. The only reason you're doing it really is for yourself. If you want to do that and it makes you feel better and it makes your plants look nicer, then go ahead and do it. With things like iris and peonies, the effect on the continued flowering or, you know, the overall health of the plant, it's not going to make a huge difference whether you do it or not. I know with some peonies, like the Ito, those hybrid peonies, sometimes if you deadhead, if the conditions are right and the moon is in the right phase, I don't know, you might get some additional blossoms. But, you know, I've done it both ways over the years, and frankly, I just don't think it makes any difference. And I'm learning to enjoy the appearance of those funky seed pods that the peonies make. I'm thinking that is an interesting feature, and I'm going to leave it there because I like the way it looks. So, that's totally up to you. With some annuals, however, deadheading can affect flowering, and so by removing any flowers that might be potentially trying to make seed, it will enhance the growth, the branching of the annual flowers, and you'll get more flowers.
Which plants?
And so, it's highly variable. So, like some of the, like a lot of the new petunias kind of self-deadhead, and you don't really have to worry about things like that. But for example, I'm thinking about this hanging plant called Lophospermum that only flowers like mostly on the terminals of the branches, and it gets really long. So it's not just deadheading, it's actually cutting it back, like taking a few of those long stems and cutting back to a node to encourage more branching. So any plant that you're looking at that has, in the case of Lophospermum, hanging down, in the case of, for example, one of the annual dahlias, it's growing tall, or zinnias, for example, they're growing really tall. By deadheading, and removing the stem down to the next node, you're actually encouraging growth. You're encouraging branching. And with all of those types of annual flowers, the more branches you have, the more flowers you have. So it helps to deadhead. So it's not just, you know, whether or not it makes you feel better. Well, ultimately, it will make you feel better because you'll have more flowers. But it can be super time consuming. So, you know, choose your plants that you really want to focus on, unless you just have all day to be out there deadheading.
Barbara?
So I hope that helped.
Barbara, I hope that helped. I think it did.
A little physiology in there, but it helps to understand how plants grow.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned hanging plants.
Yes.
And it seems to me there's, well, not a revival of it, but it seems like more people are getting into hanging plants.
We have always, at the greenhouse that I've been working at for the last, well, since I retired from my retirement hobby job, part-time temporary retirement hobby job, that I'm there all the time because it's so much fun. We sell a huge number of hanging baskets, and even now, I mean, we still have some, but we'll do custom hanging baskets for people all the time with all kinds of things in them. I mean, it's not just petunias and calibrachoa and Lophospermum. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can put in a hanging basket, and they do seem to be really popular. We have a couple of people that we plant for that have these really huge baskets. You know, they're like 30 inches. You have to have a substantial hook for those. But sure, yeah, hanging baskets are always popular. This year, begonias were, we just about sold out of all of our begonia hanging baskets, but they were so beautiful. And begonias are something you can put in the shade. And so if you have an area in your garden around your patio where you have a tree or multiple trees, you know, you can put these begonia hanging baskets out there and really get a nice bright pop of color. Just some of the new begonias are almost fluorescent in color. They're so bright and vivid.
I love them. I mean, they're really...
They're beautiful, yes. And there's so many different kinds. Yeah. You know, there are plenty of begonias that you can put in sun. But the ones that really are hanging down, you know, like the Florencias and the Bovillias, those are shade, and they are gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. I just can't say it enough.
I had it one more time.
I have this picture in my head, and it's just like, those are just fabulous.
Oh, man. Patty Nagai, our guest, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. She's a retired horticulture educator with UW Extension. And if you have a question, I hope you join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. I see we have quite a few emails already, but we can get to you. You email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Wonderful to have her back with us. You were talking about seeds. And how people are always buying plants instead of using the seeds. Well, here's one from Matthew, which he has a plant that nobody ever buys the plant. They always, I think, buy the seed. And that is the corn plant. And sweet corn. And he wants to know, when's the best time of the year to get corn planted in your garden?
Oh, corn. Do you know that that's what my PhD is in?
No. You were a corn gal.
Corn, environmental stress physiology of corn, but not sweet corn. It was field corn. So I studied corn for a really long time, but that's two different things. It just cracks me up when people ask about corn plants, though. I do have people come into the greenhouse and ask for corn plants.
You're kidding.
I do. It's true. And I don't even sell sweet corn seed. And the reason for that is that most people in our area don't have the kind of land you need to grow an adequate amount of sweet corn to get good pollination. And so for sweet corn, the soil still needs to be kind of warm. I know that the farmers who grow it for farmers markets tend to plant it as early as possible, and they will go out and reseed if something happens, but they always take that chance and plant it as early as possible in southeast Wisconsin. They'll go out in May and plant it because they want to have the first sweet corn of the season.
Yeah.
But if it gets too cold, if it gets too wet, you know, that seed rots. Boom. And they have to replant. So, but they take that chance. In a home garden, it's not so much when you plant it, except for the soil does need to be warm. It's how you plant it and how much you plant. To get really good pollination, you have to have at least eight rows. And it has to be, you know, a good amount. You can't just plant like eight plants. You need to plant a lot of it because pollination in corn is asynchronous. So, you know, the tassel on the top is the male, the ear on the bottom with the silks is the female part that makes the ear. The tassel always produces pollen before the silks emerge from the ear on that plant.
Yeah.
So you have to have as many plants as possible so the asynchronicity will allow for cross-pollination between all of the different plants. So have at it. Go. Do it.
I had sweet corn. Well, I can tell you, my folks, where they lived, there was a farm. You know, they just lived on the edge of a farm.
Uh-huh.
And it was corn that went in behind, and the farmer was good friends with.
Yeah.
And there were like three, four houses, I think, in this little row.
Right.
And he would plant sweet corn in the first several rows along the houses, and then the rest was field corn.
Right.
And he just said, "Go have at it."
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that's the way to do it. Find a farmer. Yeah, it just takes a lot of space and a lot of, and you know, there are different types of sweet corn that have to be pollinated by other sweet corns. You know, if you're near a field corn and you get pollen from, it can affect the flavor of the corn. So yeah,
my mother would go out and she'd wind up freezing batches and batches. You know,
right.
And it was always great in December or January to have.
My grandfather grew sweet corn in his garden, but his garden was like an acre. Well, and it was the kind of sweet corn, you know, the old varieties like Silver Queen, where you would harvest it in the morning, and my grandmother would have the water boiling on the stove. He would bring it in, and it would instantly go into the boiling water, and then she would take the kernels off and freeze them or can them. Yeah.
Well,
it was like a really fast process.
This guy, this farmer told me one time, the best thing is to do is to get the water boiling, carry the water out to the plant, and have initially have it shucked, and then just lean the corn over and stick it right in the boiling water.
Yeah, that's not real practical, but I can see where he's going with that, because the enzymes that start breaking down the sugar... They start right away.
Right away.
Yeah. But with the new sweet corn varieties, they're a lot more stable. So they've kind of deactivated those enzymes, and now the sugar content stays high even after a few hours or days in some cases.
Jay in Plum City has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jay.
Hi there, Larry. I actually have two questions, I guess. One is pretty simple. Does a person need to plant more than one variety of muskmelon to get good pollination? I know some watermelons you do. And my second question is, maybe 14 years ago, I got a couple purple irises at a garage sale. I put them in a flower garden, about a 20 by 30. And now, basically, I have a 20 by 30 of solid irises, which I'm trying to figure out how to deal with that or eliminate.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay, two great questions. So... No, you can get great pollination with a single muskmelon plant. Like, they make enough flowers to pollinate plenty of fruit. You know, the ratio of male flowers to female flowers on any of those cucurbits is going to be pretty high. Early on, when they first start flowering, it's all male flowers, so more pollen than is needed for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll when the conditions are right and the plant deems that it's time to make a female flower, it'll make one or two female flowers, and you'll probably have 20 male flowers. So as long as you've got bees flying around, you'll have plenty of pollen for that. And no, they don't need cross-pollination. they're perfectly capable of having the enough of the right kind of pollen to pollinate the flowers on an individual plant.
Well, what about these irises that have taken over?
Well, that's what they do. That's probably why it was at the garage sale or wherever you got them from, because they multiply. My husband just killed a whole bunch of iris in my yard because it was completely infested with thistle that we could not get rid of. So that's one way to do it. You hire my husband to come in and clear cut and spray with some noxious chemical to kill it all out. You can dig them out. That's really, that's your other option. I used to be a big proponent of sharing plants and, sharing plants with your neighbors and friends, but I just don't do it anymore because where we are, we have jumping worms.
Yeah.
And I'm very leery of getting a plant from somebody else's yard just because of that. You really don't want other people's problems in your garden.
So get the spade out.
Yeah, just start digging. Yeah, they can be pretty prolific. And
I'd leave one, and then 5 years from now you can dig them all up again.
Yeah, it takes a while for. Iris are beautiful.
I mean,
I like iris.
Yeah.
I do. I do like a variety of colors though, and where my husband just clear cut. They were all pretty much one color, so I'll just have to start over.
Let's talk about succession planning before we go back to the phones.
Sure.
How does that work with the annual flowering plants?
Well, annuals are wonderful because the flowers, there's so many variables and so many different colors and heights and things, and you can plant them all season long. So a lot of times with annual flowers, it's more about when something goes wrong and you can't revive it, or it's overgrown or it doesn't look right anymore. It's super easy to just pull them out without feeling guilty and plant something else. With perennials, it's a different story.
Yeah.
Because with perennials, that succession of bloom is something that you have to think about before you plant anything.
Which I didn't do.
Well, no. gardeners are like that. You see a plant and go, oh, I have to have that. And I have to have that one too. And I'll figure out what to do with them when I get home. Right. I know how that is. It's one of the joys of gardening. But with perennials, every plant has a distinct bloom time. So, you might plant Amsonia and Baptisia for your early bloom, and then maybe you'll have some different iris varieties to follow that, and then you'll have some different types of colors, and you have the salvias and the nepetas and the veronicas, and then the things that bloom in the fall, you'll add in some of those asters and different types of coreopsis that flower later. So there are lots of ways to do that with flowers. A lot of times when we're talking about succession planting, it has to do with your vegetable garden.
Yeah, yes.
So, and this is something that people don't always have a good grasp on unless they've been gardening for a long time. But, for example, bush beans are a short-term crop.
Yeah.
You can plant bush beans in succession, like every 2 to 3 weeks, to get beans all the way up into fall. Whereas other crops like Brussels sprouts, you plant those a little bit later, maybe in June, but you don't harvest it until October. So it's taking up your garden space June, July, August, September, and into October. So then prior to Brussels sprouts, maybe you want to plant something really short season, lettuce, radish, things like that are a little bit faster, beets. Things that are cool season that you can get in and out of the garden and then plant your Brussels sprouts for later on. So there are a lot of different ways to look at succession planting.
Yeah, I like to let those Brussels sprouts stay out there a long time.
They take a long time to mature. They do.
And you don't want to get antsy at the end.
No. They'll taste better if you wait until it's
cold. Dave in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Actually, I have two questions, and I'll wait for the to ask the second one after my answer the first one. And that is, since you brought up your husband using noxious weed killer for thistles, I have a terrible time with thistles and quackgrass. So if I were to use Roundup for that and kill everything off, that should kill off the thistles and the quack grass, I think. Let me know. The other question is, then if I go in there and start working with the soil and all, is that going to be harmful to me? That's my first question.
Yeah, so it's super important that you read the label of any chemical that you decide to apply. So Roundup is a brand name, and Roundup makes a lot of different types of weed killers. The general Roundup that's sold to the public these days is not glyphosate anymore. It is a combination of like three or four different chemicals. There's a grass killer in there, and there's like two or three different broadleaf weed killers. So it doesn't have any glyphosate in it at all. To get a chemical with glyphosate, you have to get the professional strength one. And honestly, I don't even know if that's available to the general public or not anymore. So no matter what brand you're buying, it could be Weed Be Gone or Trimec or Roundup or any number of things, you just need to read the label very carefully and look at the chemical combination that they have in there. The more chemicals you have in there, honestly, the better it's going to be for the killing the thistle. But even with that, it's probably going to take two applications. Thistle is hard to kill. It has an incredibly deep and spreading root system. And in addition to that, if you have ever let it seed, if you have ever let it flower and go to seed, the seed can hang around in the soil for 20 or more years. So you could have thistle coming up even after you've treated.
Killed the other ones.
Killed the parental units. You're still probably going to have thistle coming up. It's a hard one. It's a hard one to get rid of, but I always recommend you always must read the label carefully. There is always a safe way to use these chemicals, but you must follow the label instructions to be safe. And then afterwards, I would say, you know, they say that with the glyphosate, it was actually pretty straightforward because it would dissipate, it would bind with the soil, it would break down after a pretty short period of time. But with all these new chemical combinations, you know, each chemical has a different warning with it about how dangerous it is.
And in terms of going back and working in the garden, it will tell you on the label.
It will. It'll tell you when it's safe to go back in there. But even then, yeah, you know, I always recommend wearing gloves no matter what.
Oh,
because
yeah.
There are other things in the soil that might not be good for you either. So, yeah.
And you had another question, Dave. Did Dave have another question?
He said he had a second question.
Yes, and it's twofold. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can, yes.
Okay, so once again, using Roundup or some type of harsh chemical to kill a very invasive bamboo. And I was told that you want to wait till fall and use it because then it's putting all the nutrition into the soil. But
yeah.
Then the second part of that is, did you ever hear of a weed killer called Avenger made from oranges? It's an organic weed killer.
No, I'm not familiar with that one at all. I have used some other types of organic weed killers, and for the most part, the issue with them is that they burn off the top, but they don't actually kill the roots. So for something like thistle, I don't know how many times you would have to apply it to get decent control of the thistle because it's only going to burn off the top part of the foliage. But I'm not familiar with Avenger, you know, at all. And then as far as the bamboo goes, oh gosh, bamboo is really horrible to get rid of. And if it's that Japanese bamboo, I think that there are some recommendations on the DNR site about how to approach killing that. It takes a number of different steps in order to really get rid of that. So I would recommend that you look
that up on
the... I think
go to the DNR website.
I think it's on the DNR website how to get rid of that. I think it involves some different types of chemicals and cutting and digging and spraying and then doing it all again multiple times.
Yeah. Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joe and Duran, we'll go to you. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Quick question. I was wondering if there's a herbicide that would attack or would protect my moss gardens and could clean up the weeds. It's really hard to pick out weeds with a pair of tweezers to keep your moss garden clean.
Oh, yeah. But that's the therapeutic value of it. That's what you're supposed to do. I am not familiar with any. I'm not an herbicide specialist. Yeah. I know enough probably to be dangerous, but yes. No, and I'm not familiar with anything that you can use in a moss garden. Sure, there's a specialist within the... is there a specialist who could answer that question? Like,
I'm thinking. I'm not sure. Jeff will probably be looking around to find something.
There's probably somebody in the university specialist who
stay listening, Joe. We'll have something for you. We have a couple of questions. We'll go back to corn for a minute. Fred called to say you can grow corn in 2 rows. 3 rows is better, but 8 seems excessive. He's had good luck with only a few rows.
I'm so glad he's had good luck with that. Okay, I'll say this. It depends on which way the wind is blowing at the time that the pollen is being dispersed. So I'm glad he's had good luck with it. But, corn is fickle.
Ross in Bayfield emailed. He planted ornamental corn about 2 weeks ago in Bayfield. Mm-hmm. About half of it germinated, doing well. If he reseeds this weekend, will these new plants get successfully pollinated by the first plants? Should he reseed in adjacent rows or in one sparsely germinated row?
Clump it together as much as possible, so that they... Or you could do hand pollination. When you're only talking about a few plants, I've grown corn in pots and pollinated by hand, so... I guess my rule about 8 rows is not legit because I have planted single plants in a pot and had them successfully produce ears of corn, but I hand pollinate. So
yeah, so there you go. Brian in Madison, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about what would be the right herbicide to use for thistle on my farm road. Quick background that abuts a creek. About 3 years ago, he stopped moving. The wildflowers came. It's beautiful. And then the thistle moved in.
Right.
So the thistle, what kind of thistle are you talking about? Is it Canada thistle?
Because of it, there are some native thistles that would be a part of a natural wildflower garden. So you really don't want to kill those. Mm. I would suggest that you find out exactly what kind of thistle you have. Yeah. And then determine whether or not you really want to kill it. So thistle in a wildflower garden, as long as it's not the invasive one, it's not a bad thing. There are so many different birds that depend on thistle seed for their food. So
Brian's got a whole bunch that come in. But I would you need to identify what thistle you're...
And it's risky in a situation like that because you've got two things that are concerning to me. One, it sounds like it's a pretty large expanse of soil, butts up against a waterway. There are some severe restrictions about using herbicides near any kind of waterway. And then thirdly, it's a wildflower garden. So, anything that you use to kill the thistle is going to kill your other flowers.
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer for that either.
Brian, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Perennials are up right now. How can you tell if they need to be divided?
Well, there are a lot of signs that perennials need to be divided, with things like iris. The rhizomes, you'll see them actually overlapping each other and you might have a decrease in bloom. So, you should definitely dig and divide and inspect them for any insect damage at that point. With things like hostas, when they start to exceed the space that you want them to be in, or they're overcrowding another plant, you don't have to divide them. I mean, I have plenty of hostas that I just let them do their thing.
Yeah.
Of course, they're the ones that the deer eat all the time, so they get pruned back on a regular basis. But you don't have to. Things that are not flowering, enough. Sometimes things just, perennials are sometimes short-lived too, so you may not be interested in dividing. You may just need to replant and start over, or put something else in that place that's going to give you a different look that you want. I've been having challenges with some of my grasses, my perennial grasses, because they've reached the size where they look like craters. You know, the grasses have moved out and the center is completely empty, and it's a great place for the rabbits to nest and my dogs to run through there and dig them up. So there are always things that can be done in the perennial garden. But so there's no such thing as, you know, like a completely low maintenance or no maintenance perennial garden. There are always things to do, but it doesn't have to be done, you know, like right away. You can plan it out and do it on your own time when you have that spirit ready to do it.
I like that. I like your thought. I like your thinking.
I have been called a lazy gardener because I have gardens all over my property. I have all kinds of gardens. I have native gardens, butterfly gardens, truly ornamental hybrid kind of crazy things. You know, I've got it all in different parts of my yard. So I can't be out there doing that all the time. So I look at it and go, can you wait another year? Yes, you can. And that's what we're going to do.
Peggy Sue in Brilliant has a comment, I believe.
Okay.
Hi, Peggy Sue.
Hey, how's it going? I really love your hilariousness as you carry on. I totally agree. I've had really bad arthritis attack me the last 10 years, and so things have slowed down, but the weeds have not. And that was why I called. I had a friend who always believed in keeping her creeping Charlie because she was a quote-unquote naturalist, and I can agree with that, except when it gets so bad it's crawling up the side of your plant in a garden.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's got to be a way. So what I have found works really great is Fleet Farm and Tractor Supply carry it. It's called Amine, A-M-I-N-E, 400, and it has a dye in it, so you know exactly where you sprayed it, which is wonderful. It smells kind of funky, but it's okay because it's a broadleaf killer. It will not kill quackgrass. It will not kill a lot of other things, but it will kill thistles. What you need to do is if you can cut the thistles in half, take the tip of your sprayer. Don't go out there and just start spraying everywhere because it'll kill everything.
Right.
But spray the direct thistle plant, each one of them, soak them. Just soak them. Once you have cut the top off, they're kind of hollowish in the middle.
They are, it's true.
And they'll soak that right up.
You takes it right down into the root.
Yep. Fleet Farm actually also carries a 41% glyphosate. So we still have a really good weed killer. Of course, you have to be careful. And I tell people this all the time. They're like, well, doesn't that cause cancer? And it won't if you don't spray it all over the place. I've seen people spraying, and they're like spraying everything.
Right. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I love the idea of these chemicals having a dye in them so you can see exactly where you've sprayed them. And I think, honestly, I think all herbicides should have that in there so you can see exactly where you're spraying it instead of just, you know, just widely spraying all over the place. So, yeah, I really appreciate that. And then, the glyphosate that is available, it's that professional strength glyphosate. And I think it's still sold as Roundup, but maybe it's under a different name because that's not a proprietary chemical anymore. So I think they sell it under different brand names other than Roundup now. But yeah, the glyphosate cancer thing was a horrible, horrible event that, I don't know. I think any chemical can be used safely. You have to be respectful of what you're doing. And that's true even with the organic pesticides.
I was just thinking
some
the
of the
same
organic
thing.
Pesticides are highly toxic, just really toxic. You know, you're not worried about cancer at this point. You're worried about death,
living.
You know. So, sure, any chemical can be dangerous, including the things you have around your house, you know, Clorox and ammonia. That's deadly. Well, so you just have to be careful and follow the label instructions on whatever product you choose to use.
Our guest today, Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. Thanks for joining in today for Garden Talk. Just to mention, on Monday's program at 11, we'll be talking with tech person Beth D'Angelo. She's going to talk about setting up a home Wi-Fi system and choosing a browser that's best for you. Then we talk about using fossils in museums, and then take a look at new research that reshapes our understanding of human ancestry. All that on Monday from 11 to 1. Right now, we're in Garden Talk with Patty Nagai, and many callers online. Joyce and Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Joyce.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have been listening about the problems people are having with thistle, and I have creeping thistle throughout so many of my gardens, and I choose not to use chemicals. So I went online and I was reading about horticultural vinegar, and that it will get rid of thistle, but you have to cut it a few inches from the top of the soil and then carefully place the vinegar on the cut, and it supposedly will make it down to the roots, and it dries up the roots. And I'm still waiting for my order of vinegar to come in, but I'm wondering if you've ever used it, if you have any thoughts about horticultural vinegar.
Yes, I have used it, and it is a product that has, it certainly has its place in the industry. It can work, but again, it's, and it is a chemical, so you need to understand
that
it is still a chemical, and it still has some dangers associated with it. It is an incredibly strong acid, and so if you get it on your skin, it will burn you. It's very strong acid. So the issue with vinegar is not so much that it doesn't kill the plant tissue, it does, but sometimes it kills the plant tissue too fast, and it does not penetrate down into the root, and it does not kill the root. And so for the horticultural vinegar to be effective, it, in my experience, it usually takes several applications, you know, repeated applications in order to kill. And I did not had any luck using it on thistle. But I hope it works for you, and I hope you will report back and tell us that it worked, and you know, that this is the key to doing it is, you know, the cutting and applying the chemical directly to the cut surface. Sometimes that does work better for a lot of different types of chemicals if you have that cut surface for the plant to absorb it down, get it a little bit closer to that root tissue. But yes, horticultural vinegar is a useful product. But again, it's a chemical, and it needs to be used safely.
Thanks, Joyce. Appreciate it. Liz and Madison, your turn. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call today.
Sure.
So my questions are about poppies.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful orange poppies with the black centers mm-hmm. in Wisconsin. When do I plant those? How many should I plant? Will they work in sort of a part-shade clay-like soil?
I have grown poppies, a lot of different types of poppies in part shade. I have done both from seed and from plants. My seeded ones actually have done better. And you'll find that once you get poppies established in an area, you will have poppies forever because they seed quite readily. It's now my most favorite weed next to my lemon balm. In my garden areas, I have poppies all over the place. And I have a lot of different colors. Interestingly enough, the orange ones have not reseeded. And those are the ones that I planted from plants. So I had them for several years. And then a couple years ago, they did not come back. But my purple and blue and kind of a lavender colored poppy, all of those are very prolific. And so my original seeding I actually did in the fall, and that was a long time ago. And I just sprinkled the seed in the areas where I wanted poppies and a very light covering with like a organic compost kind of thing. And I just ignored them. And now I seriously, I have poppies everywhere. I have poppies everywhere. I will tell you, a little bit of poppy seed goes a long way. So good luck with that. So,
good luck with that, Liz. Thank you for calling. Kay in Maryland, Wisconsin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. The guy that has the moss garden.
Mm-hmm.
I have a moss garden, and it's gorgeous. And I've got the little figures and stuff in there and weeds. What I did is I went to the hardware store, and I got a battery-operated hand clipper because I've got arthritis. I can't squeeze the thing. And that thing, it goes right down to the ground. It just clips all the weeds right out. You'd never know you got a weed in there.
Wow, that's great.
And it's really fun to use.
Yeah. Maybe I need one of those, too. I've got a little arthritis in my hand as well, so that sounds like a plan. I was, you know, when he first brought up the whole thing about the moss garden, I keep thinking, I lived in Japan for 2 years, and I keep thinking about the moss gardens in Japan, and every time I would visit the moss gardens, there would be a woman in there wearing a very traditional Japanese outfit and the big straw hat, and she would be very carefully picking out weeds and leaves, like, one at a time. She would go through the whole garden, and that was an everyday job for her. She did that every day.
Well, Mary in Madison called to say she had good luck removing weeds from her moss garden by lifting up the moss in sheets and then removing the weed roots.
Getting the root out. Yeah, that's a great idea, too.
Just lays it back.
Just lays it back. I love moss gardens. I don't really have a great place for one in my yard, but I just think they're so peaceful and tranquil. It reminds me of Japan, so it's a beautiful thing.
And we did do an interview, Jill is now reminding me, with a very good moss expert.
Oh.
And let's post it up here on site. Anyway, we'll...
Can you repost that so that people can learn more about moss gardens? Is it that the man that... I think he lives in... Does he live in Waukesha somewhere?
Let's see. I'm just... Dale Siebert?
Yep, that's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
He has a very beautiful garden. I've heard him speak. I've seen photos, but I've never visited his garden. But it's just, the pictures are amazing.
But you can go back and check in on the Garden Talk shows and find that. I'm not sure. Dale Siebert, I think it is.
Dale, yeah.
And maybe we'll have the date of that at some point.
Yeah, that would be great. Moss gardening is quite an art. There's definitely some tricks and techniques that you need to practice in order to have a successful moss garden.
So that show goes back to January of 2024.
Oh, that's not so far ago.
That's not so far back.
Mm-mm.
And we certainly have all of the old shows.
So everything's available online, right? So they could go back and listen to me.
They could go back and listen to the two of us when we were a whole lot younger. We are right now.
But now we're so much wiser.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm certainly in some areas I'm a lot wiser.
I try to learn something new every day. It's the beauty of working with plants.
Well, it is. And I wish we had more time to talk about those things right now. But we're coming up on our news, and we've got lots to talk about into the next half hour of the show. So I want you to please stay with us for that, because we can talk about more about perennials. We can talk about the spring season in the garden here and some new varieties of shrubs or trees that Patty really likes. So got all that, and we'll be back with that and a whole lot more after this look at the news. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here with my guest, Patty Nagai, back in the studio with us. She's a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, a retired horticulture educator from UW Extension. Questions? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Mary in South Range, Martha in Madison called to ask how to divide irises and when is it best to do that?
There are several times that you can divide iris. While they're flowering is not the time to do it. You can do it in early spring prior to like when the leaves are only about 6 inches, you know, when the leaves are first starting to emerge, you can do it then very, very easily divide them. When you divide your iris, you do need to inspect them for any insect damage and any rhizomes that are showing damage. You should cut off and discard. And at that point, if you do see that, you need to think about using some kind of chemical control to kill any remaining little larvae that might be in there. You can divide them then. And then after that point, you should leave them alone until after they're flowered. When they are completely finished flowering and you've given them a chance to completely dehisce, you know, for that flower to completely fade, you can actually divide them then. But it's trickier at that point because then we're starting to get into really warm weather. And so it's very important that you keep them watered and that you have to cut the foliage back, you know, to kind of help them get reestablished in their new area. Then the next best time really would be in the fall, to do it in the fall when you can really cut the foliage all the way back and put them in their new home, make sure that they're in good well-drained soil, water them carefully, and maybe even a little bit of mulch over them. And the only other thing about iris is that you just can't bury them too deeply.
Yeah.
So those rhizomes have to be like pretty much at the soil surface. So the springtime is probably the best because it would give them more of a chance to establish a good root system prior to winter.
Back to Japanese gardens for a minute because we will be doing a show on Japanese gardens on June 20th.
Wow. I will be listening to that because that's exciting. I love Japanese gardens.
Well, keep your phone handy. You can call in too.
I will call in with my moss garden questions. Absolutely.
Sarah in Plymouth emailed that she has some trees in her yard that seems to be struggling. Certainly an arborist is an appropriate person to call for advice.
Yes.
How do you find a legitimate tree specialist is her question.
Right. So there are a couple of websites you can go to find a good arborist. The Wisconsin Arborist Association. I like using certified arborists.
Me too.
Especially when it's a tree that is not thriving, when it's something that you want to either protect your tree or help your tree health-wise, it's really good to use a certified arborist because they will be up to date on all of the latest information about nutrition and different techniques they can use to keep your tree healthy. So, you can go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association website and find an arborist in your area.
Laura in Grand Marsh. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Yes, I have three very large gardens of daylilies.
Mm-hmm.
And for the past 3 years, I mean, I get the blooms really good. They're thriving. But after they bloom, they all turn brown. And then later on in the fall or something, they'll start turning green again. Is it because I have not separated them?
Probably. So what can happen? I mean, if you're not seeing, if it were some sort of disease or something, they would not come back in the fall.
Right.
So I, without seeing them or knowing anymore, I would assume that it's just an overcrowding issue. Daylilies, you know, much like iris and a lot of other plants like that, they do need to be divided at some point. Alternatively, I've had a couple of people who are maybe smarter than me have told me that you can avoid doing that by just making sure that you're watering and fertilizing more. So if you cannot divide or you don't want to divide, when they start to get to the point where they're beginning to flower, you need to up your water and your fertilization and make sure that they're getting a substantial amount of water each week. And you just need to give them some sort of fertilizers to make sure they have enough nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and even some of those little minor elements to help them keep going. Because if they're browning out from competition, you could help that by giving them what they need.
What they want.
if you're not able to divide them. So, you know, giving them their own space is great because every plant needs their own space. They need their own place to put down their roots. And when they're really crowded like that, they are just fighting each other for water and nutrients. So, yeah.
Well, I've got a really nice daylily bed with several. Supposedly, they are blooming at different times of the year, but mm-hmm. they have different weeks, but they don't. They all bloom.
They all bloom at the same time because they've been hanging around together too long.
That's probably it.
Yeah, they're in sync
well,
now.
They've been in there 12 years.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But they bloom really well because I followed your advice that you know they get water and they get nutrients.
Yeah, so fertilizer is important when you're in an overcrowded situation like that. I've been told that about daffodils too, because you know technically daffodils will reach the point and they will overcrowd themselves over a number of years, and if you don't separate them, they will produce foliage, and then they don't produce flowers, and then the foliage browns out and dies. But if you provide a lot of water and nutrients, they forgive you for not separating them, and then they'll flower again.
Okay. Well, so. Yeah, mine are looking pretty good yet. The plants seem to be healthy. The ones that have come up, all of them have come up.
Mm-hmm.
Jen in Madison emailed, she tends to leave her peonies up, speaking mm-hmm. of leaving things
sure.
up, but often the plants end up with dark spots.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to affect the blooming
nope.
the next year. What's going on with that?
Well, Larry and I were talking about this over the little break, and there's so many different things that peonies can get, but the good news is that none of them are, well, most of them are rarely fatal, so they don't really hurt the blooms. They don't really hurt the plant. They're just really ugly, and they will propagate to the next year. So sanitation is key. Remove infected leaves. Get them out of your garden. These are fungal diseases. There are a couple of bacterial diseases as well that can get in there, but there are some fungal diseases that can affect the foliage and not look real pretty. So you can get them out and... sanitation sometimes takes care of it, and then the next year you don't have it. You know, as Dr. Huddleston would say, Dr. Death would say, you know, fungal diseases are very opportunistic. If the weather is right, you're going to get them. Just enjoy it.
Oh, Dr. Death.
Dr. Death. He loves those fungal diseases.
Patty and the guy... does not love fungal
no,
diseases.
And, you know, occasionally I get I have Ito peonies. I don't have herbaceous ones. I only have Itos because, again, I'm a lazy gardener, and I don't want to have to prop them up and do all of that. So my Itos stand independently, beautifully.
Upright, flowering.
Flowering with their beautiful seed pods all summer long. It's just great. But occasionally I get that as well. And when I do, I cut it out.
You can join in, too, by the way. We've got open lines. We'll get you on really quickly at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Now, Janet in Hurley called, couldn't stay with us, but she cut up her iris into squares with a Sawzall. It works really well and is fast.
I have heard that. I have heard that, and I have not done that. But I have used a sharp spade to cut through various perennials, including iris. Iris, daylilies, hostas. Yes. And so it's just harder. harder work than with a Sawzall. I think next time I'm going to get the Sawzall out. I like that idea.
I think that's a good idea as well. I noticed garden centers are adding a lot of, and I don't know if this is true for yours, but adding a lot of tropical plants to their outside offerings. What do you think about using tropical plants in the garden?
I use a lot of tropicals in the garden, and I just understand that they are not hardy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you either have to bring them back in or let them become one with nature, which is what will happen in the fall. So there are a lot of things like that that we've always gardened with. You know, you think about the dahlias and the gladiolas and elephant ears. Elephant ears are a super popular garden element that are totally tropical. And if you don't dig them up and bring them inside, they're, of course, are going to die. Dahlias, gladiolas, you have to dig up those roots. Canna lilies.
Yeah.
Canna lilies are super popular and a beautiful element in the garden. They can provide you with a tremendous amount of color all summer long. And nothing like the elephant ears, the colocasia, alocasia, xylocasia. Those plants are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, if you need something really big and bold, I have lemons in my garden. I have lemon trees.
Yeah.
I have fig trees. I have elephant ears. I have banana. So do I use tropicals? Yes. Yes, I do. And I love them.
Aisha in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Aisha.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I'm trying to plant only Midwest natives this year. The rabbits love it. They're eating most of them, and I'll see how I can tell that they're native. Coneflowers have been very unsuccessful, but I'm wondering if you have any tips for other Midwest natives that might be a little hardier.
Oh, you know, there are some nice... I've had great success with some of the Joe Pye weed. The strict native, as well as some of the selected cultivars. And, you know, with some of those selected cultivars of native species, they're not hybrids, and they're not like a created plant. They are a natural cultivar that occurs. I've had great luck with those. I've also had really good luck with the Asclepias tuberosa, the orange butterfly weed, which is a native plant, and that one does really well. Some of the swamp milkweeds have been very successful in my garden, including there's a cultivar called Cinderella of the milkweed that is a selected. It's a native species that's a selection of the native species. And that one has done really well, and the rabbits have not bothered that at all. I'm trying to think what else... The rabbits don't.
I think some of that might be covered in Neil DeBole's new book.
Oh, it probably is, yeah.
I'm almost sure of it, and I'm trying to remember the title.
He is definitely an authority on the Wisconsin native species. If you don't have his reference, that would be a good one to look at, because he has lots of suggestions for things. Typically, you know, rabbits avoid things that have a strong fragrance. Like if the foliage and the stem is really fragrant. And that's why they don't eat a lot of herbs, you know, like not that those are native, but things like oregano, lemon balm, lemon verbena, chives. They generally don't bother things like that because they probably are an affront to their nasal system. They just smell horrible to them. And deer don't usually eat things like that either. So... that's the best I can come up with off the top of my head. Right.
Yeah,
now.
And Neil's book, actually, if you go to, now I've suddenly forgotten the name of his business, Prairie Nursery.
Prairie Nursery.
Prairie Nursery. If you go online to his website, I'm sure there'll be a place there where you can either order the book or at least get the title.
And
it's The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants.
Yes, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. That would be a great reference for you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he has notes in there about which ones, you know, the rabbits and deer don't eat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Aisha, thanks for calling. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Carol in Bosco Bell, we'll go to you now. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a question about my peonies, going back to them. I have four peonies that I've had for at least 4 years. and they only bloom maybe two or three buds on them, and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. My son lives over at Hillsboro. He's got peonies that's just growing like crazy. They're just beautiful and big, but he has clay in his soil. I live in a sandy area. Is that a reason? Or?
Oh, well, there are a couple of reasons why peonies don't bloom as profusely, you know, in one area as another. One is how they are planted. So the first thing is I would look at and see how deep your peonies are planted, because peonies is another one like iris where they really have to be high in the soil. So if they have sunk down or if they were buried a little bit too deeply when they were planted, that can affect growth and flowering tremendously. So you need to make sure that they are lifted up and not planted too deeply. The second thing is because you have sandy soil, you probably are needing to water and fertilize more frequently, because the beautiful thing about clay soil, and I tell people this all the time in Southeast Wisconsin because they're always complaining about their clay and their rock and can't grow anything. And I'm like, no, that's just backwards, because clay has so many nutrients. Clay has the ability to hold on to water. It has the ability to hold on to nutrients and do that great cation exchange to get nutrients up into the plants. And so, you know, you got to work with what you have. So when you have clay soil, you worry about watering too much or about things not draining really well. When you have sandy soil, you know, you don't have to worry about drainage, but you have mm-hmm. to worry about whether or not they're getting enough nutrients. Because sand doesn't hold on to anything. It doesn't hold on to water. It doesn't hold on to nutrients. It's just it's just there. So, you know, people complain about having too much sand. People complain about too much having too much clay. But, you know, my feeling is, as a gardener, you work with what you've got. And, you know, there are benefits to both. But you have to adjust your techniques to whatever soil type you have. So... fertilize. Good. Water and fertilize.
Absolutely. Carol, thank you very much for calling. Plants are expensive, and this has come up on the show in the past where relating to greenhouses, should we expect greenhouses and garden centers to stand by their plants and their products? I mean, what do you guys do at Shady Lane?
We have a pretty standard policy, I think. Most places of reputable businesses have a kind of a standard policy. We do guarantee our trees and shrubs for 1 year after planting. We provide everybody who buys one of these plants with instructions on how to care for them, and we would like them to follow those instructions. We will replace a plant. We don't refund money, but we'll replace a plant if something happens to it within 1 year, because sometimes things do go wrong. In a planting situation, from the nursery stock, sometimes we get plants that have a problem. It's true, but we try really hard to only sell quality plant material that is suitable for our area, our soil type, and our climate in our region around our greenhouse. So we are very careful about that. So in providing that guarantee and providing instructions for how the plant should be planted and cared for, we expect a good growth out of that plant. But sometimes things go wrong. More often than not, when people bring plants back, it is they were not watered. And we can tell. We can tell when they're not watered. We can tell that that is what has happened. Occasionally, it's too much water. And again... you bring the plant back, we can tell that the roots are rotted. And then the third reason is vole or animal damage, and we don't cover that. So,
and that's reputable. I think that's what you're going to find with any reputable garden center.
And we give that with our information sheet. We say what we cover and what we don't cover. We don't guarantee, you know, our annuals or our perennials, because there's so many things that can go wrong there. But we have a very our owners are very benevolent and very caring about their customers, and we are all about customer satisfaction. So I can tell you that we have replaced plants plenty of times that we know that there was something beyond our control that killed those plants, but Yeah, we have good customer rapport. Let's put it that way.
Shady Lane Greenhouse, and we mention this every time because I think it's a pretty cool.
It's a very cool place.
Yeah, describe it.
It is a family-run business. They've been in business for almost 52 years now. Mm-hmm. The family is still very much involved in the operations of the business. They have the Midwest's largest permanent display of a G-scale model railroad. And the railroad is there all the time. It's permanent. It's there. It takes up a greenhouse and a half. It is huge. We've had a tremendous number of wonderful volunteers from the Wisconsin Garden Railway Association and local artisans who've come in and developed this amazing train display. On a regular day, we might be running five or six trains, but on special event days, we could run up 16 trains at a time. And it is fabulous. It is so fabulous. But what we're really known for is the quality of our plant material.
Yeah.
So we're very, very careful about what we grow and how we grow it.
And in Menominee Falls.
Menominee Falls, right on Shady Lane, just off of Good Hope Road. Come see me.
You'd and you're there a lot.
I'm there in my temporary part-time job. Yes, my temporary part-time retirement job. I'm there almost all the time. I've had a lot of people come because they've heard me on this show. They've driven from all over the place to come see me because they want to talk about my specialty little dwarf tomatoes, or they want to see the trains, or they want to see if we have some weird annual flower, which sometimes we have because I grow strange things sometimes.
And anybody can go in and look.
Yeah, we're open all year round. We're open all year, and the train is always there. It's not always running. It just depends on who's there. We have to, you know, you have to have an engineer to run the trains. But yeah, it's a beautiful place to work, and it's a fun place to visit. So I invite everybody to come visit.
What about your own property now? I mean, how do your plants look this time of the year now?
Some things look gorgeous. I have a rain garden and a native plant garden in my front yard that even when I don't do anything to it, it's vibrant enough that it looks beautiful and you can't really see the weeds, so it's great. My vegetable garden is mostly planted. All of my containers are not planted. I've been kind of busy lately, but it'll get there. And like we started with, it's never too late to plant. You can always plant something. There is always something to plant all year long. And that's my goal in life, is to always be growing. I'm a grower.
And spreading the word.
I want people to be happy in their gardens and to grow beautiful flowers and plants and, you know, feel good about it.
Well, I'm always happy when you stop by, Patty.
Thank you. I hope you invite me again.
Oh, don't worry about that. We will be doing that. Patty DeGuy, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Madison, at Menominee Falls. Why did I say Madison?
Because we're in Madison.
But... Well, we're in Madison, but the greenhouse is in Menominee Falls. And, of course, she retired as horticulture educator with UW Extension. So it's always great to have her come by, and she will be back, and we will do this again with her. But coming up, we're going to take a look about watering in your garden. There's some ways, you know, we waste a lot of water, and there's some things we can do to make the whole process better. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News.